Welcome to The Downtime Project, where we learn from the internet's most notable outages. I'm Tom Kleinbuter, and with me is Jamie Turner.
Hi.
Before we begin, I just want to remind our listeners that these incidents are really stressful, and we peel them apart to learn, not to judge. Ultimately, Jamie and I have made, and we will in the future undoubtedly make, similar mistakes on our own projects. So please view these conversations as education rather than judgment of mistakes we think we would never make. So today we're going to talk about Monzo's outage in July of 2019. So I don't use Monzo, and I wasn't really familiar with it, but according to the website, it lets you open a bank in the UK and spend, save, and manage your money. So I'm pretty sure they had a similar feature set in 2019 when they had this outage. The website also says that over 5 million people have a bank account with them, which is a pretty decent number. You know, there's probably a fair number of financial transactions per day on average for people. So 5 million is a pretty good number, but you know, it's still a few notches below the scale of something like Facebook or Google. So yeah, that takes us to the afternoon of July 29th when things got exciting. So Jamie, how would you summarize what happened?
Yeah, so July 29th, 2019, Cassandra was misconfigured when they were in the middle of doing some maintenance to it, and it led to site issues, including folks not being able to log into their app, not being able to send and receive payments or withdraw money from ATMs, and not being able to see balances and things like that. In addition, some customer communication channels seemed to not be working as well because they also relied on Cassandra. So before we kind of dig into the timeline of the outage, Tom and I wanted to talk a little bit about Cassandra, since Cassandra is sort of the center of this issue here. So what is Cassandra? So Cassandra, for those of you who do not know, is a NoSQL database originally written at Facebook, and it's a Apache Software Foundation project. It was being used by Monzo for a great number of things, it ends up, as we'll discuss when we go through here, including financial transactions. So it is a quorum-oriented database server. So unlike something like, let's say, MySQL, which has a primary replica system where the primary accepts the writes, and then either synchronously or asynchronously, the replication channels stream those records, those transactions to the replicas. In a quorum-oriented system, the write path has essentially quorum members for each key. So if there's a big key space of many, many, many billions of keys or whatever, they'll split that key space up and then determine that, let's say, these three machines are responsible for replicating this set of keys. And the way those machines replicate those keys are they ensure that two out of three of the nodes need to be online, need to be able to ACK the key has been successfully written to disk in order for the transaction to be considered committed. So, and it does this via some protocols you might have heard of, things like Paxos or Raft and things like that. So it's a database architecture that is theoretically more robust to the failure of nodes and to linearly scaling up and scaling down, because the key space can be redistributed in really incremental fashion and stuff like that. But these systems actually are often, I will say out of the gate, they're often more sophisticated, more complex internally, and it can sometimes fail in surprising ways, so that are a little more opaque from the outside. So in 2018, they had these 21 servers in a single Cassandra cluster, and they were essentially had, sounds like, most or all of their business transactions running in that cluster. And they were starting to get near load limits. They don't detail exactly what bottleneck they were hitting, but they did say in their summary here that the database cluster was starting to get too busy and they were going to need to scale it up. So because of that, they decided to add six servers, and July 29th, the day we're about to talk about, is the day they began to expand their cluster of Cassandra.
All right. Yeah, the whole quorum idea is so cool. You know, ideally or theoretically, you just, you know, one server just goes away, you drop in a new server, the data just backfills, and it's just magic. You know, like it's such a cool idea. But yeah, I think maybe a little too much magic sometimes. But anyway, yeah, let's run through the timeline. So at 1:10 in the afternoon, they add the six new servers, they connect to the cluster. They thought they were putting them into the cluster in a completely passive way where, you know, nothing at all should change. And so they saw what they expected. No metrics seemed to change. All the reads and writes looked fine. So 4 minutes later, they get an alert that a small percentage of MasterCard transactions are failing. They never get into why it was just a MasterCard transaction alert, but it's not super relevant. 5 minutes in, so 5 minutes after they add the servers, they go ahead and declare an incident, which is a pretty quick response time. 14 minutes in, the engineer who was doing the database changes notices that an incident has been filed and joins, I assume, the chat or the Slack channel or whatever they were using for this. They rule out the scale-up because there's no change in errors in the database. The read and the write graphs all look the same. And it seemed like a no-op at that point.
Yep. Yeah, it's interesting to note this here that even though there was no evidence yet they were related, that the engineer was really on the ball and ended up joining the incident just in case, because this engineer knew they'd just done something to database cluster. So, yeah, no evidence yet that was true, but just one of those things where I just changed this. It's fairly significant. So there's a real chance this is related. So let me get in the room with the rest of these folks.
Yeah, that was very good instincts there. So at that same moment, 14 minutes in, they do find a bug in the MasterCard code, just 10 minutes after they get the alert for it. So I'm guessing it was a pretty straightforward stack, something pretty simple. 5 minutes after that, an internal edge service starts failing.
Yeah, it sounds like in this case, and a lot of companies have these, this internal edge service is a kind of gateway that relays authorized internal employee traffic to internal services, things like dashboards and things like that. And so it's a proxy with some authentication checks. And in this case, it checks for IP ranges to make sure it looks like it's an internal network or whatever. And this particular edge service, spoiler alert, had some configuration data that was keeping in Cassandra.
Oh boy, I think I know where this is going. Okay, so 22 minutes in, they get an alert from customer support that they're hearing from their customers that people are being logged out of their app. A minute later, they've got the MasterCard fix ready, but they can't deploy because the internal tools are broken, because of that edge service being down. 6 minutes after that, they deploy the MasterCard fix with some manual fallback mechanism. They don't say whether they just SCP'd it up or whatever, but they managed to get the MasterCard fix out to the service running it.
Yeah, this is actually really impressive. Whatever this mechanism is, the fact that 15 minutes after they fixed this bug in the code, they not only had this code pushed via their primary deployment mechanism, they actually had already used some fallback mechanism successfully. It's actually pretty remarkable that. So
yeah, it's interesting. Simplicity is such a virtue in so many parts of the system, but I would love to know what actually happened here, because if this was just them copying a file, or just doing something very trivial versus having to go build a whole new container and push it out into the system somehow. So I'm curious what that actually was.
Right.
Did they run that through CI? I'm curious.
Yeah. That might have been just an rsync or something that people looked over somebody's shoulder, and who knows, but they did get the code out, and that was good. Impressive they were that resourceful.
Yeah. So for the next, 36 to 38 minutes in, they find that the configuration service that the edge service uses is returning a 404, which was very unexpected. About 10 minutes later, they realize that only some of the configuration keys are missing from the configuration service. So it's not it's just failing for everything. It's just failing for some subset of stuff. 3 minutes after that, they realize that the configuration keys that are missing from Cassandra.
Oh boy.
And I'm sure there start to be some serious stomach dropping feelings around this point.
And I bet that engineer was happy that they joined that incident, so they were in the loop for all this. Yeah.
Yeah, because about 13 minutes later, they realize that the missing keys are being served by the new Cassandra servers.
Yeah, is, I guess, about an hour in at this point. And so, yeah, at the point where the missing keys are being served for the Cassandra servers, it was clear that this new deployment had something to do with the incidents they've been having, I'm sure, to the team. But Cassandra, when we were talking about reading the notes here, it was really interesting that what had happened is the new Cassandra servers were what had happened is that the new Cassandra servers had assumed some responsibility for a portion of the key space. So the cluster had included those 21 to 27, I guess now, servers. When they increased the size of the cluster, the key, the sort of hash ring, consistent hash ring that is responsible for distributing the key space evenly across the servers, it had reassigned some of the key space to be owned by some of the new servers. And the issue is those new servers, because they were trying to deploy those new servers in a passive mode, clients were essentially looking to those servers to be able to provide the values that they were looking for to their queries. But those servers, because they were in this kind of half passive mode, they did not have the data and they were not really relaying traffic to the machines, which still had the data. So they were sort of responsible for servicing queries for the data coming from clients, but at the same time, intentionally not servicing that data. So basically the system was in a state where it had broken itself by half redistributing the data within these new servers.
Yeah, definitely not what was supposed to happen.
Yes, probably not what they planned.
Yes. Yeah. But it was probably very fast. Yeah, you know, it was
That's right. Those 404s were lightning quick. Yeah.
So, 5 minutes after this, they start removing the servers. But, this is complicated. You can't just, hit the power button on these things. There's a procedure for safely removing these from the ring. And so it takes, I think they said about 10 minutes per server, 8 to 10 minutes per server. So it takes them about an hour to get all the servers done. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm imagining at this point that sort of unwinding that process where whatever portion of the key space had been assigned to be owned by these servers was basically shuffled back to its prior state, so that the initial set of 21 servers now was once again responsible for the entire key space.
Yeah, and I'm also assuming that a large amount of the engineering org was highly invested in this at this point and was trying to figure out. I'm sure some kind of message went out saying what was going on. Everybody start thinking about, we may have lost data. Let's figure out, how we can verify that we're back into a good spot. So they spend the next 8 hours. A little bit unclear exactly what they do, but they say that they replay all the events that have been written out and that they run consistency checkers and they verify that everything is back the way it should be.
Yeah.
They did say that once they finished removing the servers, so about 2 hours into the outage, that the majority of customers were able to access their data or their money and just were okay.
Yeah. I mean, what Tom and I had theorized, because there's a little bit of missing information here, is that when they say 2 hours in after they go back to the original cluster 21, their statement is only so confident is to say the majority of customers were not having issues. And then they talk about this next 8 hours, referring to some external logs or something to replay events is the terminology they used. But what may have happened is that when the key space got redistributed, although they had not moved over the existing data to the new servers so that they could successfully serve the like historical keys, it may be that new keys were written to disk on the new servers. And so that may be what encompasses here the whole majority of customers were okay at this point, is it was only the sort of new customers during this 1 to 2 hour window that had written some keys into these new servers that potentially temporarily those keys disappeared from the database when they shrunk back down to the original 21. So that's the best sort of inference I think we can make from what this next 8 hours was about and why it kind of took them that additional 8 hours to get 100% of customers' data back online.
Yeah, it is a little bit unclear. Yeah, with 10 minutes to remove a server, or 10 minutes to remove a node, you would expect that it's doing something like copying data off. But I mean, even if everything had been perfectly fine, I would have expected them to spend the next at least 8 hours verifying everything was right. So it's hard to really say.
Yeah, it is a little tough to reconcile the care that they put into safely removing these database servers to go back from the 27 back to the 21. with the fact that it seemed as though it took them some time to get all their customers' data back online. So it's not quite sure what happened there, but so we're reading between the lines a little on this one.
Yeah. All right. So that's the whole thing right there. Kind of a short and sweet one. But ultimately, and there's a great section in their blog post about this, about the setting that caused this. And if you use Cassandra and you don't know about the setting, you should go read it for sure. But ultimately, they misunderstood what this setting called auto bootstrap did. So when this is on, when you plug in a new node to the cluster, data is just going to get streamed to it. And this is kind of the magic ideal experience you want with a system like this. You know, you just plug this thing in, it connects to the node, it gets all the data that it's supposed to fulfill, and it can just start serving reads and writes. You know, that's the dream. That's the magic of this kind of system. But they had auto bootstrap off. Previously, the previous year, they had added some servers, and after it was complete, they had turned it off so that if they had to restore a server, they could do it from backups and it could go a lot faster, you know, because when you put a new server in, I mean, there's probably, you know, I don't know if it's terabytes, but it's certainly a large amount of data that would have to get streamed over. It's a lot easier to do that if you can just, you know, already have the data on the machine, just drop it in.
Right.
But yeah, that, I'm just checking my notes here.
The auto bootstrap stuff, it kind of a fascinating setting that Tom and I looked into a little bit too after reading this postmortem. They were confused by it, and I have to admit, like, we were confused by it too. It was a little hard to understand what state it got in. It sounds like what Monzo thought was going to happen is their servers would join the cluster so that the other 21 servers essentially included them in the set of 27 servers that were kind of communicating together about the database. And it would be seven more servers ready to take key space, but not yet taking on any key space until like that was initialized one at a time on the servers. It seems like somehow kind of what auto bootstrap did is it actually did make those servers immediately responsible for some fraction of the key space, but without moving any data over to it or without serving any kind of relayed request.
It sounds like a corrupt my data if I'm adding more than two servers flag.
it really does not sound like a super super great setting. So yeah. I could definitely see why Monzo was a little surprised that this was behavior, because it's unclear why anyone would ever want this. I'm sure there's some story about why you would want servers to own the keys without being able to service requests for the keys, but like I really struggle to find what that use case is.
I mean, maybe if it's functioning as a cache or something like that, I'm not really sure. But
right.
A key point here, though, is that they had tried this out in a test cluster, but the fatal flaw was that they'd only added one server in the test cluster. And so because their quorum is at 2 out of 3, I mean, you could have one server just on fire and it would all still function perfectly fine. So yeah, that props to them for actually testing this before they deployed it. But yeah, with just one server, you wouldn't have caught this type of bug.
Yep. Yep.
Or not bug, but configuration thing.
Right. Yep. Cool. Well, that's exciting day and definitely great notes. Thanks, Monzo, for writing up that postmortem. And I think that, yeah, as we were saying, auto bootstrap, I think actually I could see any team I've been on being confused by what that flag means for sure. So definitely a tough outage. And cool.
Yeah, you typically expect that settings, it's not so easy to put your system into just a really bad state.
Like, right. Yep. Yep.
You know, it sounds, yeah, I would have been tricked by that for sure.
Right. The setting should just be called break my database, right? With underscores, you know, yeah. Like no one would ever opt into it. So, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm reminded of one of the command line arguments to the MySQL client, which is --, I am a dummy. Have you ever seen that one?
Yeah. Yep.
I love that. I love it.
Right. So,
anyway, if you've never used that, it I think it, oh man, I'm forgetting now. But I think it will fail if you run any queries that aren't indexed. Hmm. Like if you run a query on, you run a big select on something that's gonna have to go to a big table scan, it'll just fail. Anyway, I may be misunderstanding that. I'm sure someone will let me know. But oh well, you want to talk about what went well?
Sure, yeah. I mean, so I think there's a ton of things in this actually where the operational team that was responding to it did a lot of things very, very impressively right, in my opinion. The responsiveness and proactiveness here was really rapid. The bug fixing got done really quickly. The engineer proactively joining another incident that occurs because they figure, oh boy, I just touched a database. I better go see if it's my fault, right? So, like, the rapid response, the amount of ownership, you definitely got the sense that all hands were on deck and everybody was, like, you know, was really urgent. It was bringing urgency to solving this problem and was not waiting to be asked to come look at stuff. They were showing up just in case. Like the postmortem just had that feeling that, like, folks were proactively making themselves available and digging into things. And so it's hard for the timelines to be as tight as they were in this postmortem without the team having that kind of dynamic going.
Yeah, they didn't really make any mistakes. Like they fixed something that ended up not being the root thing, but they didn't make anything worse. You know, like, you know,
right.
Sometimes if, I mean, as we talked about in the last episode, sometimes when you're responding to an issue, you can make things a lot worse. But, you know, they diagnosed it pretty quickly and they safely got back into the state they wanted to be in.
Yeah, they had very, very sensible responses to a major database problem like this with a black box database that is doing Dynamo style, like, consensus oriented replication. And when something goes wrong with that, it can go wrong to the tune of a lot longer outage than this. And so actually their recovery time here, and if you look at how quickly they worked through the diagnosis and the remedy and all that kind of stuff, like, it's pretty well executed actually for something this complex. Like, when distributed databases go wrong, they can go just really, really wrong. And this team did a pretty good job responding to the incident and reacting as it evolved. So
yeah, definitely.
Well, let's see. Another thing we definitely have to call out is they had a test cluster, right? So
yeah,
you know, again, anytime somebody has a test cluster and prod's not the first time they tried something, it's always awesome to make sure to point that out. So as Tom mentioned, they only increased it by one node, so it didn't completely replicate like what they were going to do in prod, but there's a whole host of other issues they probably didn't run into in prod because they did that ahead of time. So kudos to them for that.
Yep. I was really impressed that they had a log of events in a separate store that they were able to work with very quickly and replay and make sure that things got back into the right state.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, that was awesome. Like, the fact that they had this external event log that they could restore their systems with and verify their systems with, and the fact they verified their system, right? Like, now I know Monzo processes payments, so, like, you would say, well, hopefully they would have muscle for that, but, like, I don't want to take that too casually. Like, there's a lot of places that actually conduct fairly serious transactions that maybe wouldn't have done as well here as Monzo did. So they had that log available both to recover data, but also, as they say in their postmortem, they actually validated that their data state, it, not just the missing records, but that all of it seemed to represent everything it should. So that's definitely a big plus on their side.
Yeah. I mean, if you're running a complicated system and you're not running consistency checkers on it, it's probably not right.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
Extremely unlikely to be correct.
It is, and the longer you let it rot without knowing when it first breaks, the harder it's going to be to reconcile it, like, years later. Like, it's because the reason why it's wrong years later when you run your consistency checker is actually 17 reasons, right? And then you have these reactive reasons, like, oh, it was first degree wrong when the initial bug was made, but then, like, you read that data and reacted to it with, like, secondary and tertiary reasons why it's now. So your corruptions are not just, like, initial source corruptions, they're also, like, odd data that's a reaction to incorrect data, right? So
yeah, I mean, old incorrect data is like, it's like, you know, just archaeological strata. I mean, you might find some data in there that is wrong because there was a bug 4 years ago, and, you know, the person that created the bug is gone, the person that fixed the bug is gone, And, you know, you have to troll through years of commits in the code to even find out why on earth this was ever written out.
Yep.
If you can just have your consistency checker light up an alert, you know, as soon as that first event hits, you're going to be in such a better state.
Yep, definitely. Cool. Yeah. Let's see, what else?
Just general response time. You know, they got alerts from customer support 20 minutes after the bug or the servers went up. They got alerts about automated alerts about the MasterCard failures like 4 minutes later. I mean, that's awesome. That's exactly what you want to see. Just that rapid feedback.
Yeah, and cross team too, right? When your CX team and your engineering team seem to be able to communicate in a first class way together on an incident, like that's a really good sign, actually. So, because like, you know, what you don't want to see is these organizations sort of ossifying into their own like cultures that like never talk to each other, and like, because sometimes like in big incidences, like the most key information about what's going wrong are things that the CX people know and not things the engineers know. Like ideally our metric systems and our logging systems would be perfect, and they tell us exactly what's going wrong and how bad it is. But every once in a while, like the people that know the most about like how bad things are the end customers and the folks that work with them. And there have been times where I've certainly been involved in incidents where when we do forensics later, we realize that if somehow engineering had known what CX knew, that would have solved the problem faster. And so it seemed like those channels were strong here.
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, yeah, I think you make a good point. That is a lot easier to have that when organizations are small, you know, and everybody just kind of sits together and, you know, everybody knows everybody. But hanging on to that as the org gets bigger, you know, and things change with CX because of, you know, costs or whatever, I think it's really good that they still have that. We don't know how big they are, but you know,
right.
That's just great to have that kind of communication.
Yep. The fact that they had an internal edge service that had some sort of authentication built into it. And so that's great to see as well. So yes, it sort of was a piece of what made things more complicated here, but like the fact that existed and they were, you know, making an attempt to take their internal tooling pretty seriously from a security standpoint, like that was also pretty impressive.
Yeah, I definitely like to see that. And we touched on this a little bit during the timeline, but I just thought it was great how quickly they got that MasterCard fix deployed. You know, clearly, I mean, that means somebody out there really knew how everything worked and was able to go around the regular things. I mean, I don't know how their security guys or their auditors would feel about being able to deploy code that quickly, but you know, it shows that your engineers know what's up for sure.
Yep, definitely.
Well, cool. All right, let's talk about what might have gone a little bit better.
Yeah, well, there's, you know, a few things in here for sure. I mean, one of the things it's probably fair to point out of the gate, right, is that like Cassandra is a fairly fancy system, like, and I mean that in all the ways that are good and bad, like. You know, database RDBMSs, the NoSQL various offerings, the different architectures they take. I think you and I, Tom, have run into most of them at one job or another. And something like Cassandra is certainly has characteristics that are extremely interesting to an engineering team and to an operational team and stuff like that. But it does feel like one thing here that is a little bit suspect that could be challenged is they're doing money stuff, right? So like people couldn't get money out of ATMs. People were shown the wrong balance in their accounts. It appeared that they had lost money or whatever. Cassandra might not exactly be the right tool for when you're dealing with people's money.
Yeah, I would love to know the line of thinking that, you know, just again, the kind of the archaeology of how you end up in a situation like this. Because in my mind, I mean, relational databases are they're the gold standard, like money is why you use a relational database, you know, like,
right.
Like all the examples, the history of them, the countless engineering years that have been put into making them just completely rock solid.
Yeah. Especially when you're doing things involve transactional, like essentially what inside of a Cassandra cluster would be like cross shard transactional type behavior. Right. So like cross partition transactional, behavior, like, RDBMSs, there's just so much literature about them. There's so many millions or billions of production hours that have gone into running things like this on an RDBMS. Like, I mean, you could even consider your storage architecture kind of tiered potentially. Like, if you want to use Cassandra for lots of things in your company because it has characteristics you want, cool. You might want to at least put the money stuff on a small RDBMS, and just because it's gonna, there's this whole spectrum of like, you know, how much risk can it tolerate versus like how much of a pain is it to operate or whatever. Like, definitely, I think when you're talking about the money stuff, that should be, you should be using the most boring technology possible for that. Yeah, you know,
absolutely. I think, which is kind of why I'd love to hear the kind of backstory. Like, I don't know if Monzo started out as a bank and from day one, we're going to be a bank and all our technology choices are this, or, you know, did they start out as like, we're going to, you know, give you information about banks or something like that, where, you know, you would want to optimize more for not having to fool around with sharding, things like that. So, you know, a lot of choices that look bad on the outside, you know, were actually made for different reasons. And, you know, so I would be just curious how they ended up in that state. But yeah, if I was doing something with money to start with, I'm going to use a relational database. Probably going to pay somebody to take care of it for me.
probably just use Postgres, right? Like RDS Postgres or something.
Yeah, RDS Postgres is...
It's boring, but it works.
And you can just go and last time I looked, you could get an RDS instance with 384 gigs of RAM or something.
Right.
You can put a lot of data into that, and, yes, and it's going to be really quick. And as long as your indexes and stuff are right, like,
that'll take you a long way. Yeah.
You may not have to shard.
Right. Like, yeah. You know. That's modern hardware is so powerful that, like, especially if you can tier your type of traffic and your type of storage, right? Like, mm-hmm, if it's just like your transactional core of your bank thing, you might be able to reduce your transaction load to the point where you can live a very long time on just a very powerful database server and not worry too much about like two-phase commit across shards or anything like that. So it's definitely worth trying to do the boring thing for the most critical stuff if you can.
Yeah, I mean, if you have to write two things and they have to be written to two different disks, like, that's just a much harder problem. Like, if you have two things you have to keep in sync, and yeah, it's, if you can have it all in one disk, life is just easier and easier to reason about.
Yep.
So.
Cool. I mean, there's also a question about, like, could they have added the servers more incrementally, like one at a time? I mean, tossing six on there and seeing what it does. That's a pretty big chunk, right? Like, especially if you have money flowing on this or whatever, you could be extra paranoid and maybe spend a little bit more operational. I mean, the first time you've done this operation in a year plus, if it takes a little longer because you do it a server at a time, especially if it's the first time you've done it in a while, like, it might be worth thinking that through too. Could they have just done it one server at a time? You know, this, as we know now, it seems like that would have worked. We wouldn't have known why, but at the same time, if it didn't blow up, it didn't blow up. Right. So, you know, if you're going to learn the lesson about what is it, if we add 6 to 21 things, that's probably what you should have tested. Right. If you tested adding one thing, then go add one thing. Right. So again, if it's your most critical database, right, like, you know, do the most conservative thing possible. And like, what are you trading off there? Like a little more time, right? Like somebody has to babysit doing the operation 6 times instead of once. It might be worth it for resizing your database cluster.
Yeah. Yeah. Six is not a huge number. It's not like they were trying to add, you know, 400 servers to a cluster of 10,000 or something.
Yep. Yep. For sure. Cool. They also maybe could have, you could say it'd be great to have more Cassandra expertise in-house. Now, one reason why I think that's a little unfair, even though, of course, it would be wonderful, is the one of the challenges with these more sophisticated databases is that there's not that many people that are truly expert at them. And also the bar in some respects for being an expert is like even higher, right? So I think the places where they often work out really well are really big shops that like kind of have the people that wrote the database working there. The people that didn't write the database, there's a very small number of people that actually know how the system really works in enough depth, I think, to like deal with it when it does something squirrely. Like, so it would have been awesome for them to have a Cassandra core team member or something working there, but it also may not have necessarily been realistic or, you know.
Yeah, I think that does raise another thing to just think about whenever you're making technology choices is, you know, how much expertise for this technology is there in the world, and is it obtainable by you? You know, like,
yep.
I mean, I would think about this when you're picking a language, when you're picking libraries, when you're really doing anything. I mean, like, using a new language might be a great idea, but if there's no one on your team that's an expert in it, and it's very hard to hire experts in it, you may end up just not using it very well. And you may end up in a worse place than just using something that you can just go, you know, find a good person in. So,
yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And just a general note on sharding is, there's going to be some magic involved with sharding. And, you know, not, I mean, obviously it's a pretty understood problem in the industry now, but, you know, because stuff like Cassandra is super appealing because it sort of hides all the magic, you know, underneath a layer that you don't really have to know about. And that's going to work great some of the time, but clearly cases like this, it's going to fail. Like, and when it fails, you know, the magic is not in a code base that you understand at all. So doing sharding in your application is a big pain, but if there's a problem with it, you're going to be able to fix it because, you know, it's the code that people in your company will have been working with. So yeah, in general, avoid sharding if you can.
Yep. Cool. Yeah. I mean, I do want to point out, even though it's awesome that they had this internal edge service, like, I think this is one of the themes we're going to see a lot in these sevs, right? Is like anything that smells like circular dependencies is really bad, right? So what it ends up happened here, right, is that they kind of needed production to fix production, right? So they couldn't deploy, it sounds like, probably because this internal edge wasn't working and some tooling that would be used to do the push the normal way was behind that. They also, too, there was another reference in there where something like communication channels or something between customers were potentially using this database. So that, you know, it requires some real diligence and tenacity and to like keep your eye on, you know, your database works most of the time, right? Your whatever, your network works most of the time, but like, you know, so it's easy to slowly slide into places where you actually need production working in order to know if production is broken or fix production. And so like it sounds like a case where even though it was amazing, they were able to fix it anyway, like kind of everything used this one database cluster, right? And so when they changed it and it didn't go right, their lives were, it was harder to get their world put back together.
Yeah, it's so appealing to just have everything in one place. But yeah, I mean, the other thing I think about with this is just the security. I don't know what kind of security layers you would have with Cassandra, and if this stuff is pretty segmented, but it'd be a little worrisome to me that, you know, like, you know, every service would need access to the database with transaction, like financial transactions on it. You know, you would think you'd want to, for a lot of stuff, you could have it on a different database that you would let more services access or something.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the interesting thing, right, is like, config, right? So like, even if you were going to re-examine this, right, and this is maybe what they did, because like if you read their postmortem, they say now they use several database clusters. If they had three database clusters, okay, let's say one was like social activity, right, upgrade that one first.
Yeah.
Right, and then after that, right, let's say the second one is transaction data, if you're going to keep it in Cassandra, maybe update that one second after the social one works, right? Probably the last one to upgrade is config, right? So put your production configs in the last one because like that's the one that has to work, right? Mm-hmm. So you have live traffic. You can classify that into like hurts a little, hurts a lot, two different like layers, right? Two different severities. and do your like hurts a little stuff in a separate cluster that's isolated both from a security standpoint. Make that the first one you try upgrades on, make that the first one you try new code on. And then, you know, maybe you have your second production database, which is more critical transactional stuff, your customer stuff, go after that when it's worked well for like the non-critical stuff. You're anything that's like a part of a production path that you use to do the first two steps, you try to avoid doing that if you can. But if you're going to have it use the same system, maybe do that last, because you might say, oh, well, the money should happen last because that's the most. Well, the problem is nothing can really get fixed right if your tools are broken. So you have to kind of upgrade your tools last if you're going to have those kinds of dependencies.
That's a great point. Yeah.
There's an interesting one of the many things you can like go into, and I don't know the details, but if people in the listening audience were interested, is there's some history. Someone told me one time I used to work with who was very involved in how Google was designed for a long time, where Google uses GFS to kind of bootstrap lots of new systems at Google, including like new data centers and stuff like that. But yet GFS is a system that runs in data centers, right? And so, but there's some real discipline around, and it doesn't always work out, right? But like, if you're going to do something like that, say we have this tool that's really valuable to us, we want to ride it for all kinds of purposes, right? There's practices you need to put in so that your circular dependencies don't kill you. Like, for example, using a very old venerable version of that thing, right? That gets updated much less frequently and like, it's known bad in what ways it's known bad and stuff like that. So, and probably for a smaller company, you're not going to do all that kind of stuff. So if at all possible, maybe just do something simpler with config, you know, maybe just use config files or, you know, something that isn't going to break right when you need it to be online to fix your production database or whatever. But cool. Well, that was an interesting one. Is that maybe, are we good there, Tom, you think? So that was interesting. Are we good there, Tom, you think?
Yeah, I think that's just about it. I just want to call it one more time. I think this is a really well-handled outage. You know, nobody wants to have a problem like this happen, but you know, I think a lot of times we're really judged by our response to it, and I think they did a great job getting the site back up and running quickly and being able to make sure that no data was lost.
Sounds good. I agree.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to The Downtime Project. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you'd like to read a transcript of the show or leave a comment, visit us at downtimeproject.com. You can follow us on Twitter @SevReview. And if you like the show, we'd appreciate a 5-star review.